Israel pushes ahead with its deadly airstrikes on Gaza. A refugee camp is one of the largest, the latest targets, with 8 children and 2 women killed in the attack. Palestinians laid to rest 11 people killed by Israeli forces during protests across the occupied West Bank on Friday. Also ahead, more Iranian political figures, including former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, sign up to join the race for the upcoming presidential vote. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip with its warplanes, naval boats and tanks, causing more deaths and destruction in the besieged Palestinian territory. Earlier, Israeli jets targeted the Ashati refugee camp in northern Gaza, killing 10 Palestinians, all of them women and children. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the attack, describing it as a full-blown war massacre. Also, Israeli jets once again pounded residential areas in Gaza City and Khan Yunis. The regime's naval forces, as well as artillery units deployed near Gaza, also shelled the coastal strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says at least 132 people, including more than 50 women and children, have been killed since Monday. Over 950 others have been wounded in the attacks. In the meantime, Hamas has conducted more retaliatory rocket strikes against Israel. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon says Israeli warplanes, tanks and naval forces continue to pound the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli fighters just continue to pound the Gaza Strip, and Israeli Navy and tanks also attacking the Gaza Strip. Minutes ago we heard that a residential tower was also hit with a drone rocket in preparation to completely destroy it. Israeli forces have been doing this since Monday, since day one of this onslaught. And it seems Israeli regime is determined to kill as much Palestinians as possible during its attacks. Despite the Israeli attacks and the increase of the volume of the Israeli attacks, Palestinian resistance groups are not sitting idle. They're retaliating. Just seconds ago, several rockets were fired towards the Israeli regime. Resistance groups immediately after the attack on the Ashati refugee camp fired volleys of rockets in retaliation against the Israeli regime.
Meanwhile, Palestinians lay to rest the victims of Israel's deadly crackdown on protests across the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have killed at least 14 Palestinians in the occupied territories since Monday. This includes 11 people killed on Friday alone. Meanwhile, over 500 Palestinian protesters were also injured in Israel's crackdown. The Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli forces have been targeting the Palestinians with live rounds. A Palestinian security source said the protests are the most intense since the second Palestinian uprising that began in 2000.
More Palestinians have been killed and hundreds others have been wounded in a fresh Israeli crackdown on the occupied West Bank. The crackdown came in several areas after Palestinians held rallies to denounce Israel's massacres in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Gaza is under bombing. All Palestinians must take part in the protests and go to the military checkpoints. If we stay at our homes, nothing will change. We must fight those Israeli occupying soldiers wherever they are.
We are all in one tunnel, all Palestinians who live in the lands that were occupied in 1948, in Al-Quds, in the West Bank and in Gaza. We are today fighting by different means the Israeli occupation. Innocent people and children are being killed in cold blood. The least to do is to protest.
In occupied Ramallah, hundreds of Palestinians intensified their participation in the ongoing anti-Israel protests. Following Friday prayers, people from all walks of life and from different political affiliation marched toward the Beit El military checkpoint located outside the city. Palestinian activists taking part in the protest said the crimes and violence by the Israeli forces require a serious reaction.
Our battle is won. We are all today united in defense of our goods. The Israeli occupation is the enemy of the Palestinian people, wherever they are. After all these years, the Palestinians in the land occupied in 1948 are sending a message to the occupying regime that nothing succeeded to let them forget their historical right, change their culture and identity.
Israeli forces' violence has also seen a spike in the Palestinian cities occupied in 1948, like Lod, Akka, and Haifa, including attacks by Israeli settlers and destruction of Palestinian property and the burning of mosques, amid the Israeli regime's fears the conflict could even spread.
Protests against Israel's full-scale war on the besieged Gaza Strip have spiraled rapidly all over the occupied territories. Palestinians say a new uprising against Israel is in the making here in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. Al-Quds and definitely will reach the lands occupied in 1948. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
So Israeli forces killing scores of Palestinian women and children in the occupied the besiege of the Gaza Strip. For more reaction on that, let's bring in Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer joining us out of Badi. Barry, welcome. You see what's going on in the besiege of the Gaza Strip, the indiscriminate attacks against the Palestinians are there. Yep, you've got some Western governments that are giving the narrative that the Palestinians don't have the right to respond. They don't have the right to self-defense.
Well, look, I mean, that's quite clearly absurd and contrary to well-established principles of law governing occupations. There's absolutely no doubt that Palestinians have a right to resist. They have the right to armed resistance. In fact, there's a UN General Assembly resolution that confirms that. And if armed resistance, if we can use that term for a moment, was good enough to be celebrated as a cause when the Greeks and the French and the Italians and others used it during World War II, then there's absolutely no reason to imagine that somehow it's not a legitimate tactic, a legitimate response when used by Palestinians to deal with the injustice meted out to them by their now long-term occupiers. So I reject out of hand any implication, suggestion, or claim, be it by the highest authorities in the United States, the White House, or anyone else, that somehow Palestinians do not have a right to defend themselves. Of course, if you ask some of these people, they will claim that that's the case. But of course, these are not expert people. Indeed, the President of the United States himself spends most of his time dealing with pretty boring routine matters, as well as his toileting habits and everything else, and then sits in most days on a lot of meetings where he gets given talking points and executive summaries, but is by no means expert on most of the things that the president professes to express an opinion about or policy about. Those policies are delivered to the president by the usual suspects, the same corporate-funded think tanks, very often dominated by special interests. So there's no reason to take anything that might dribble out of a president's mouth about these matters as being the last word, because much more often than not, they get it horribly wrong. And of course, they were very willing to denounce that tendency when Donald Trump was doing it, getting it wrong, but somehow seemed to take a different approach when now we have President Biden very much missing in action and really quite delusional
right
in his assessment of what's going on in Palestine right now.
You see, Barry, as we speak, the breaking news that medics say a family of 10 have been killed in the latest Israeli strike on Gaza. And this is the latest in a series of attacks that have wiped out entire families. These are non-combat units. They're not soldiers, they're not forces, they're not, they don't have arms. And we're seeing the skyline over Gaza, which looks like more bombs have been dropped. Do you see any other way for the Palestinians to resist other than armed resistance? Or do you see any other way for the Palestinians to respond other than armed resistance, considering families of 10 are being killed and families of 7 are being killed, despite the fact that they don't carry arms?
Look, if I can take a moment to unpack that, let's start with what's actually happening, that is essentially the targeting of civilians. There is this delusion that we've been operating under for decades, many, many years in Western nations, that somehow war is about engaging and taking the fight to legitimate armed combatants, when in fact, all we have to do is go back to World War II and everything that's happened since to understand that war is all about targeting civilian populations. Never has that been more true than when it comes to what the occupation does in Gaza. Remember, Gaza is one of the most heavily populated urban areas on the planet, and we've had successive campaigns by the occupation using the latest military technology, happily provided by the United States with support from France and the UK as well, to basically launch missiles into heavily populated areas to blow up high-rise buildings and basically shoot at whatever they decide to shoot at, clearly to terrorize the population. This is not about surgical strikes aimed at legitimate targets. This is all about targeting the population. In fact, they're doing the very thing which they claim Palestinian groups do by sending rockets into occupied Palestine, when in fact, if we break that one down too, it doesn't take much study to work out that a grand total of about 40 people have been killed since the beginning of time by all the mortars and rockets fired from Gaza into occupied Palestine. And almost all of those people were actually coincidentally members of the Israeli fighting force and were killed during major military offensives against Gaza. The Palestinians did that, started using this largely symbolic form of resistance, having unilaterally given up suicide bombing and other tactics which the Israelis complained about, choosing instead to give peace a chance. And for a 10-year period following the Second Intifada, the incidence of supposedly fatal terrorist events claimed by Israel itself was reduced unilaterally by the Palestinians by about 95%. And for giving peace a chance, the occupation doubled down and continued to steal more land and carry out more major military operations against Palestinians, especially those in Gaza. So this is all lunacy.
Barry, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we have run out of time. I'm going to have to end it there. I'm very sorry for that. We should have discussed that more. That was Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joining us out of Bali. Now, staying in with the Palestinian, the escalation there, the military escalations and the tensions, fresh rallies have been held in several countries in condemnation of Israel's deadly crackdown on Palestinian protesters in the West Bank and its aggression against the Gaza Strip. Protesters in New York City called on the U.S. government to stop funding for Israel, whom they described as an apartheid entity. They carried banners and placards with one reading, "Zionism is terrorism." In the Australian city of Sydney, thousands of people came out in solidarity with Palestinians. They also chanted slogans against Israel's occupation of Palestine. Cities around the world, including Washington, D.C., London, Istanbul, and others, have witnessed rallies over the past week as Israel ramped up its aggression. The Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has condemned Austria for raising the Israeli flag over government offices in Vienna. Araghchi, in a tweet, called the measure, quote, "shocking and painful He noted that the regime has brutally killed the tens of innocent civilians, including many children, in just a few days. Araghchi also reiterated Iran's support for the Palestinian people. Earlier, Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz offered condolences to the Israeli regime, saying he ordered the hoisting of the Israeli flag over government offices in the capital. This comes against the backdrop of pro-Palestinian rallies held in Vienna earlier this week. Mike Harris is the editor at Veterans Today and joins us now out of Phoenix. Mike, welcome. It's good to see you. You could say the Austrian government is hoisting the Israeli flag, but are they alone in hoisting the Israeli flag? Because everyone else is hoisting the Palestinian flag and raising the Palestinian flag with the demonstrations and the voice of the people across the world, not just in Austria.
Well, it would be nice to find a way for both groups, the Israelis and the Palestinians, to get along and coexist. But the Israelis have been the aggressors since they invaded Palestine and murdered millions of Palestinians and displaced them to refugee camps in Syria, in Lebanon, other places. Israel has consistently been the aggressor against the Palestinian people. And when is enough going to be enough? You know, the Palestinians have endured 73 years of brutality and abuse by the Israelis. And the Israelis come back and say, well, we have the right to defend ourselves. Well, I think the Palestinians also have the right to defend themselves. And if things were to be brought to parity, Palestine needs to be reconstituted as its own standalone country. And the world needs to re-examine what Israel is and what they've done, and look at historically their record for human rights abuses. And this attack on Gaza is really too much, and it's a bridge too far.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much indeed for your time. Mike Harris there, the editor at Veterans Today, joining us out of Phoenix. Now that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. House Democrats pressed ahead on Friday, 14th of May, with a bipartisan proposal to create an independent commission to investigate the January 6th Capitol attack. After reaching agreement with a key Republican to drop his party's demand that it look at left-wing violence unrelated to the assault. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Nicholas Fandos. The piece is titled, Democrats Move Closer to Setting Up January 6th Commission With or Without GOP. As Democrats pressed ahead on Friday, 14th of May, with a bipartisan proposal to create an independent commission to investigate the January 6th assault on the Capitol. After reaching agreement with a key Republican to drop his party's demand that it look at left-wing violence unrelated to the assault. But it was not clear whether GOP leaders, who have insisted any such inquiry, study Black Lives Matter and Antifa, a loose collective of anti-fascist activists, would go along with the deal. The uncertainty raised the prospect of a shutdown in the House of Representatives next week over the investigation and the Republican Party's reluctance to reckon with the deadly attack on Congress by a pro-Trump mob. The proposal agreed to by the top Democrat and Republican on the Homeland Security Committee would provide Congress with a nonpartisan government-wide accounting of what led to the riot and hampered the response by law enforcement, as well as recommendations to prevent a repeat. Modeled on the commission that studied the 11th of September 2001 terrorist attacks, the body would deliver its findings by 31st of December. Inaction, or just moving on, is simply not an option, said Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, who reached the agreement with Representative John Katko, a Republican from New York. The creation of this commission is our way of taking responsibility for protecting the U.S. Capitol. The proposal could break a partisan logjam that has persisted for months over the composition and mandate of such a commission. But Republican leaders in the House and Senate did not immediately say whether they would support it. Representative Kevin McCarthy, top Republican from California and a House minority leader, said shortly after the announcement that he had not signed off on Mr. Katko's plan and still needed to review its details. A spokesman for Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Senate Republican leader, declined to comment. Still, the announcement of a compromise suggested that Democrats were prepared to simply go around most Republicans in the House, if need be. That would force GOP lawmakers to choose between embracing an investigation of a riot inspired by Donald J. Trump, which is likely to anger the former president and alienate their constituents who revere him, and opposing an accounting for the deadliest attack on the Capitol in more than 200 years. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House would vote next week on the legislation creating the proposed panel. At the same time, she plans to move ahead with a vote on a long-awaited bill that would provide $1.9 billion to bolster the Capitol's defenses, reimburse the National Guard and other law enforcement for protecting the complex in the attack's aftermath, and cover costs relating to the coronavirus pandemic. Republican leaders have not yet endorsed the spending measure either, calling it premature. But Democrats believe holding a prompt vote will force GOP leaders to the negotiating table. The measure's provisions include more than $500 million to reimburse the National Guard, which has supplied thousands of troops to patrol the newly fortified Capitol, $350 million to create retractable fencing and new security screening sites at the complex, $160 million for hardening windows and doors, more than $175 million to protect federal judges and courts, and $40 million to fund prosecutors going after suspected Capitol rioters. It includes smaller pots of money to equip Capitol police officers with body cameras and increase protection of lawmakers as they travel the country. Many of the initiatives were recommended by a panel led by Russell Honoré, a retired Army Lieutenant General appointed by Nancy Pelosi to investigate Capitol security. The Capitol Police promptly issued a statement saying the funding would help the department move forward to meet our evolving mission. A pair of measures and the protracted deliberations surrounding them underscored just how significantly the violence has rattled and reshaped Congress in the months since the riot occurred, including by worsening its partisan divisions. The attack was one of the most violent in American history. More than 140 police officers were injured. At least 5 people died in connection with the rioting. The Vice President and members of Congress had to flee for their lives, and the Capitol building itself was badly damaged. And initial reviews by congressional committees and other government watchdogs have already turned up troubling evidence of avoidable intelligence and security failures that made matters worse. Proponents of a bipartisan commission argue that putting outside nonpartisan experts in charge of the fact-finding will improve the investigation and help calm partisan nerves. Some senators, whose after-action hearings on the attack have been bipartisan, feel the need for another inquiry is less urgent. An independent bipartisan commission will remove politicization of the conversation and focus solely on the facts and circumstances surrounding the security breach at the Capitol, as well as other instances of violence relevant to such a review, Mr. Katko said in a statement. Republican Representative Katko is among the most moderate House Republicans and was one of 10 in his conference to vote to impeach Donald Trump in January for inciting the insurrection. His position mirrored that of another of the 10 representatives, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who Republicans purged from their leadership ranks this week for her vocal repudiations of the former president's election lies and her party's complicity in them. Liz Cheney said that Republicans did not want a narrow investigation into January 6 because it threatens people in my party who may have been playing a role that should not have been playing. I'm very glad that they rejected Leader McCarthy's suggestions that somehow we should dilute the commission, Liz Cheney told ABC News on Friday, adding that Kevin McCarthy absolutely should testify before the body about a phone call he had with Donald Trump as the attack was underway. But the two Republicans appear to be in minority. Many of the party's loudest voices have undertaken a concerted campaign to downplay the Capitol riot and deflect attention from it by pointing to the unrelated actions of activists aligned with movements on the left. Representative Louie Gohmert, a Republican from Texas, offered the latest example on Friday when he took to the House floor for an hour-long speech that argued that the rioters who smashed windows, clubbed police officers, and threatened to hang former Vice President Mike Pence that day had essentially been peaceful. Representative Louie Gohmert from Texas accused the Justice Department of abusing its power to harass and punish conservatives who have come to stage a nonviolent protest that day, whilst going easy on the looters and destroyers in Portland, Oregon. The overwhelming number of people caught up in this, quote, unprecedented investigations, as the Justice Department promises, they're actually nonviolent, peaceful Americans, Gohmert said. Their only crime was supporting Donald Trump and concern about the fraud Democrats have been telling us about in elections for many years. The denialism have left Democrats furious and flummoxed over how to respond. One of them, Representative David Cicilline of Rhode Island, who served as an impeachment prosecutor against Donald Trump, started asking colleagues on Friday, 14th of May, to support a resolution censuring a handful of the Republicans who had been most outspoken in misrepresenting the Capitol attack. The deal struck by Mr. Katko also included concessions from Democrats. After pushing for an agreement that would have given their party more power to choose who would serve on the commission, they accepted a 50-50 split, in which each political party would appoint 5 of the 10 members. Subpoena power would likewise be shared between appointees of the 2 political parties.
The debate.
The besieged Gaza Strip has been under heavy Israeli airstrikes and artillery attacks since Monday. More than 120 Palestinians have been killed, with nearly half of them being children and women. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, as well as in major Israeli cities, have held solidarity rallies which, as expected, were faced with heavy-handed violence. Israeli soldiers and extremists have been brutalizing Palestinians in cities like Haifa and Lod. In this edition of the debate, among other issues, we'll be discussing the significance of such an unprecedented event which has shaken Israel to the core. Joining us on this edition of the debate, we have founding member of the National Democratic Assembly, Nur Odeh, joining us from Ramallah. Also from Ramallah, we have Mr. Mostafa Barghouti from the Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Odeh in Ramallah. Palestinians living inside the land occupied by Israel in 1948, they're also protesting against the Israeli acts of violence, making an ever united front for Palestinians against the Israeli aggression. How significant can this united front be for Palestinians at this point in time?
Well, it's very significant on more than one front. On the one hand, the Israeli right and those who normalized with Israel and normalized its colonial regime wanted to delude themselves into believing that fragmenting the Palestinian people would disconnect them from one another and would sever that bond between them. It's true that Palestinians inside the land of 1948 have a different reality from Palestinians in the West Bank, including Jerusalem and Gaza, but that did not change the fact that their national identity remained the same, that they face structural violence and discrimination because they're Palestinian, and that they also feel the anger and the pain when Palestinians are brutalized and attacked, and when Jerusalem is under siege and under attack, and especially when that attack also targets Al-Aqsa Mosque. So in many ways, this is an unequivocal message that almost 100 years of dispossession and uprooting have failed, really, to erase Palestinian identity, to fragment the Palestinian people, and to allow Israel to devour the land, dispossess the people, and kind of forget about the Palestinians. Palestine is on the table, on the agenda, whether Netanyahu and his allies like it or not, and that's thanks to the Palestinian people and their perseverance across the land, all of historic Palestine.
Mostafa Barghouti in Ramallah. Let's focus on some of the issues that are taking place inside occupied Palestine. A certain level of hypocrisy exists here. The destruction and vandalizing of Palestinian businesses and property by the extremist settlers, that goes relatively unnoticed. Well, all of this looks so eerily similar to the 1938 Kristallnacht events in Nazi Germany, where Nazi rioters vandalized Jewish-owned businesses. When Nazis did it, it was horrific. Movies were made, and Jews were glorified for standing up to them. But when it happens to Palestinians, It's just not the same.
Yeah, because you have such a level of hypocrisy. I mean, when you hear the Chancellor of Germany protesting against Palestinians defending themselves, and all she talks about is the rockets falling on Israel without mentioning the fact that we are under Israeli occupation for 54 years. And we are subjected to ethnic cleansing, which was one of the largest ethnic cleansing in modern history by Israel in 1948. And at the same time, this occupation has transformed to become one of the worst systems of apartheid, racial discriminatory system. And then look at the numbers. I mean, today Israel killed 24 Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but 10 of them are also on the West Bank. Among the 130 Palestinians killed so far, 32 are children, and 17 are women. And this is happening around the clock. In the West Bank, there are no rockets. All we had is peaceful protests, and they were responded to by the Israeli army with gunshots. And 500 are also injured, and a certain number of them will probably die because of their critical situation. So this is the problem. The problem is that we are now subjected to a system not only of occupation, but also of oppression, persecution, and apartheid. And the world, which does not hold Israel responsible for the war crimes it is committing, is practicing hypocrisy. And that cannot continue. Time has come for Israel to be held accountable to the international law.
Nur Oda, the Israeli Prime Minister is saying that we're dealing with two fronts. One is in Gaza, the other is in Israeli cities. The Israeli president also warned of civil war and more chaos. On the other hand, Palestinian unity probably is what Israel fears the most. How worried do you think at this point Israelis should be? Is this a major cause for concern for Tel Aviv?
Well, I think they should be very worried. They've built a colonial system of with racist laws that systematically discriminate against Palestinians inside 1948, allow for their brutalization, allow for their dispossession, and for their denial of their basic rights, including to development. Two of the people who died in Lid 2 days ago from rockets. They died because they're Palestinian, living in homes that were not provided with shelters, unlike homes built for Jewish Israeli citizens. So that is now out in the open and coming to haunt the Israeli system, if you will. What is happening on the streets of these towns is not only related to events in Jerusalem and in Gaza. I think things climaxed into a perfect storm, if you will, where Palestinians collectively, in all their colors of pain and suffering, if you will, kind of had a collective moment of being fed up, and they rose together, united in that anger and frustration in demanding basic rights. The Israelis can't put this under the carpet, if you will. They can't just forget about it. They can't crush it and use military tactics and subdue the population and pretend that this never happened. It is happening, and it's now out for the entire world to see that Hippocratic fallacy of Israel being the only democracy in the Middle East. Now it's out in the open. No democracy allows mobs to roam the streets and chant death to Arabs while being protected by the police. No democracy allows these mobs to go house to house looking for victims to brutalize and attack because of their nationality. So this is now an inescapable fact that Israel has to answer for, and perhaps that's why there is all that concern. They never thought they would have to face that music, if you will.
Mr. Barghouti, that's an interesting point Ms. Oded just touched upon. The Israeli racism and brutality is evident enough that a new report from Human Rights Watch has labeled Israel's policies towards Palestinians as apartheid. But apartheid, it needs international action. Need I not remind anyone of South Africa? So when will we see this international action? What more does the world need to see and hear?
Well, actually, the human rights watch report is very important. And by the way, an Israeli human rights organization called B'Tselem also accused Israel of practicing apartheid. And before both of them, there was a very important report by ISQA, which was not even allowed to be published by the United Nations, which indicated that Palestinians are now subjected to a system of apartheid, not only in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, but also in Israel itself. And it is the same system of apartheid that is practiced against Palestinians in the diaspora, who are 6.5 million refugees who are not allowed to come back home. This system of apartheid is the main reason why you see today such a united Palestinian front. This is the main reason why you see people in Jaffa, Akka, the Galilee, the Negev, in Lod, all the Palestinians are now joining the struggle, because it's a joint struggle, because they are jointly fighting against the same system of oppression. For a while, it looked like people in 1948 areas are in solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories, but it's more than that now. And that means that our struggle is not only to end occupation, but our struggle is really to end apartheid in the whole of Palestine, without exception, the whole of historic Palestine. Now, what we need is not just talks and condemnations. What we need from international communities is to translate international law into actions. Those who commit war crimes, those who commit the crime of apartheid and persecution, should be boycotted. And that's what we are asking for: boycott, divestment, sanctions. This is the system that worked against South African apartheid system. This is the system that managed to bring down that apartheid regime in South Africa. And that's what we need here, a combination of Palestinian popular resistance and struggle on the ground, combined with BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel. Many, many people are doing that, but at the level of people. Most governments, especially Western governments, are abstaining from using this system to punish Israel. And that's what needs to change. If they want to end the hypocrisy in the way they deal with Israel, they have to adopt BDS and tell Israel enough is enough and you will be punished for the war crimes you are committing. That's, of course, besides the very important acts of the International Criminal Court, which is investigating the war crimes here.
Noor, Amnesty International has said that Israel must immediately halt the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. So this is clearly, it's not a real estate dispute. Expelling an occupied people out of their homes in order to transfer the occupiers' population into those homes, that's a war crime under international law. Why is it still continuing?
Well, it's continuing because this colonial regime has not faced any consequence, because there are countries that are still determined to provide it with political cover, not just with economic assistance and military assistance, but with political cover in international organizations. We've seen the U.S. obstructing the convening of the Security Council. We've seen them halt and obstruct, even issuing a press statement on behalf of the members of the Security Council. And it's not just the United States. Frankly, there is an overall international failure to apply the standards that are supposed to be universal on Israel. There is an exceptionalism that Israel has been allowed to enjoy ever since its inception, whereby it can commit whatever crimes it wants to in order to entrench its colonial regime while being rewarded for that behavior, for those crimes, and protected from even verbal recrimination. That's why these acts of dispossession, I wouldn't even call them eviction. Eviction would imply that there's, you know, a different owner of those homes. Those families are the rightful owners of the homes in Sheikh Jarrah. And I'll tell you something else, and this is important for the viewers to understand. Israel has a law by which Palestinians who have deeds to their homes from which they were dispossessed in 1948, they cannot claim those homes. While Israeli settlers and settler organizations who enjoy tax-exempt statuses in the U.S. and in other countries can come and claim those homes, claim that land, even with falsified paper. And there are cases where that happened and where the courts would rule in their favor and dispossess Palestinians. So this is by no means an issue of real estate. And the exposure of that lie, of that fallacy, of the fact that these courts are but an instrument in the machine of oppression and persecution of the Palestinians, I think put Israel in a very delicate position, one that it's not used to being in the past. And that's why, despite everything and despite the attempt to reduce what's happening into a conflict and to only talk about rockets and so on and so forth, there's an overwhelming pressure internationally to focus on the real issue, which is the continued Nakba of the Palestinian people, the continued dispossession of Palestinians, their continued oppression and denial of basic rights. That's really what's at the heart of this, and that's why we keep seeing rounds and of escalation. It's not one incident here or there.
Indeed.
An overall system that basically makes us unable to breathe, if you will, if we're going to take that borrow that phrase in this context.
Sure. Mr. Barouti, about the international response, we can see a clear double standard, but it's not just a double standard in action. There's a double standard even when it comes to condemnations. When countries that were quick to condemn Hamas's retaliatory missile strikes, those very countries, they're silent during the forcible takeovers of homes, the brutal suppression of demonstrators, and of course when places of worship come under assault, when Israeli forces desecrated the Al-Aqsa Mosque. How do you view this type of inconsistency?
Well, it's very clear. I mean, you have an Israeli lobby which is frightening so many politicians all over the world. But you have also strategic interest. For instance, the relationship between the United States and Israel is a relationship of alliance, strategic alliance against the interest of the peoples of the region. And that's why you see them backing up Israel, not only with military aid, as was said, and financial aid, but also by covering up their actions politically in the Security Council and in other places. There is an ironic situation here where, for instance, Israel, which is considered a rich country, is the largest recipient of U.S. aid money worldwide. I mean, that tells you something. So, in my opinion, this situation is a reflection of injustice, a reflection of wrong policies, and it has to be encountered with much better work with the peoples of these countries. And I'm really happy that you see very important voices inside the Democratic Party, which is the governing party now in the United States, standing up against that. People like Bernie Sanders, who was a very legitimate candidate for presidency, the left Democratic group in the party, in the Congress, like Ilhan Omar and Rashid Tlaib and others, they are making a difference. And I believe we should continue to work with these people to expose what Israel is doing and also expose the unfair policy of the United States, but that also relates to other countries.
Ms. Ore, on the issue of settlements, the Israelis, they continue to flaunt international law. You just mentioned earlier that so far they've not faced any international repercussion. What if it were the other way around? If Palestinians, they chose to make settlements on land they felt was theirs, could they have continued this practice for years without any international backlash? I doubt it.
Absolutely not. And no country would dare to commit the kind of flagrant violations spelled out war crimes the way that Israel does. No country enjoys that kind of exceptional treatment and protection internationally. Israel has been allowed to expand its colonial project, to grab Palestinian land, that dispossess Palestinians and replace them with Israeli settlers, because it is of strategic interest, so to speak, and because it is allowed to do that without consequence due to domestic reasons and domestic petty politics in various capitals. But I would second what Dr. Mustafa said about, you know, hopeful developments and positive signs of change happening, especially in Washington with the Progressive Caucus. But we need to see more of that. We need to see more progressive forces around the world rallying and demanding of their elected representatives to better represent them, to represent what they stand for, and to apply universal standards when it comes to international law and human rights. You cannot use a different yardstick when you're dealing with Israel and still maintain the audacity of saying that you are honest or that you are a broker or even a partner in seeking peace in the region. And this region will unlikely see peace and tranquility and prosperity if Palestine continues to suffer under the wrath and under the boot of this occupation. It will continue to resist with dignity, and it will continue to oppose all of this injustice. But certainly peace would not be within reach if this double standard and this exceptionalism continues.
Mustafa Barghouti, for years we know that without the Western administered media, the Israelis, they were trying to control the narrative, try to portray the Palestinians as being terrorists and having the Israeli security being at risk. Arguably, that narrative doesn't exist anymore. Do you think that there's a clear sense of global awareness now towards the Palestinian cause?
I think, yes, there is a much better situation today than it was before. But this is a process. It's a cumulative process. I think the Israeli attacks on Gaza today and during the last few days, as well as the attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, and the process of ethnic cleansing that Israel was planning to conduct or is practically conducting in Sheikh Jarrah against the people who have been ethnically cleansed before in 1948. I think all these things build a cumulative effect, definitely. And this changes the situation. But sure. At the same time, I must say, we need to make much more efforts to bring in to the world's knowledge and consciousness the true reality about the situation and the real narrative about what's happening here. Okay. We have a war here. We have a struggle to bring in Palestinian narrative versus the illusions of the Israeli narrative, which is spreading in many places.
Okay, thank you. We're fresh out of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guest, founding member of the National Democratic Assembly, Nour Ouda, joining us from Ramallah, also from the Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council, Mr. Mustafa Barghouti, also speaking to us from Ramallah. And thanks for staying with us on Debate. It's good night.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Haider al-Bahadli, and today we have our dear esteemed guest, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Sayyid Muhsin, salamun alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
It's a pleasure to have you here, Sayyid. Sayyid, we have a very important question. Actually, it's a question that many people ask, especially in this time of equality and talking about inequality between sexes. So the question is as follows: in paradise, is there males for the females to marry, like there is in the holy text mentioned that there are some women for the men to marry? Is it the same thing for believers who are gained paradise and they enter paradise? Can women also marry men over there, or how does it work, Sayyid? Please explain.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We have a problem in when we look at the translations of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in understanding the verses of the Quran, it's been wrongly interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the Quran, when Allah says, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, or those who believed. Mm-hmm. Now, amanu itself in the Arabic literature is the masculine verb.
Exactly.
It's a masculine third person plural verb.
Mm-hmm.
But when Allah uses Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu only, it does not only include the men only. It also includes the women.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally, Ya ayyuha almu'minun, for example, or believers. Now, it's a masculine word, mu'minun, ism. Word, a noun. But obviously, generally, when Allah talks to the whole mankind or all the mu'mineen, He does not differentiate between the believing men and believing women. There are some verses in which we have mu'minun wal mu'minat, for example. Uh-huh. But when Allah is talking generally to the whole, Muslims, like Muslim world, or those who believed Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that also includes the women as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something which we need to first clarify. We need to understand the language of Quran,
mm-hmm.
or the original language, which is Arabic, that generally in a public, when someone says, O mankind, Ya ayyuhan nas, it means like it also includes the woman and the men, both. So the men and women also included. Now, let's start from the chapter 2.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning of the Quran, if someone wants to refer to the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 2, verse 25. Mm-hmm. It's on page 5. وَبَشِّرِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. Now, this is أَنَّ لَهُمْ جَنَّاتٍ تَجْرِي مِنْ تَحْتِيَ الْأَنْهَارِ. Allah has said, give glad tidings to those آمَنُوا who believed. وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. They did good deeds, or they performed good deeds. أَنَّ لَهُمْ that for them جَنَّاتٍ تَجْرِي مِنْ تَحْتِيَ الْأَنْهَارِ. Mm-hmm. There are paradises from below which, like, there are rivers, like flowing rivers. Yeah. Now, this part of the verse does not say give glad tidings to the men only.
Exactly.
It's for the women as well. It's for both of them. Now, the continuation of the verse is kullama ruziqu minha min thamaratin rizqan. They all will having the rizq, a good mm-hmm. sustenance from it. And there are like many fruits. قَالُوا هَذَا الَّذِي رُزِقْنَا مِنْ قَبْلِ وَأُتُوا بِهِ مُتَشَابِهًا. Now the last part is وَلَهُمْ and for them فِيهَا in it أَزْوَاجٍ